Hi, Sue. It's Nick Potts. Thanks for having me back again.
Oh, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us again. It's been really helpful having these conversations as we sort of trace our way through this pandemic that we've been living through in the last few months.
Absolutely.
So
I'm glad it's been helpful.
Yeah, it has. And as per usual, this interview is going on the land of the Kaurna people, but we hope that it will actually spread a whole lot further than Kaurna land, because people that have already been listening to some of the interviews I've been doing have given me some really good feedback about how useful this process has been. So again, thank you.
Oh, so that's great news. I'm glad to see that it's helping some people or helping some communities.
So one of the things that a lot of people are talking about, and it's certainly been on my mind a lot, is the collective anxiety that people seem to be feeling. And you mentioned in a previous interview that we all need to have hope. And with what's going on in the world around us, it's sometimes hard to see where there is hope. Do you sense that as well?
Look, you know, it's interesting. I think there are people that are always the glasses half full, and people that to a degree are always the glasses half empty. And, you know, while I think events of the day and can influence that, I think some people tend to spend most time in one camp or the other, but can occasionally jump in and out. However, I would agree with you that I think globally there is I don't know if it's a lack of hope, but I think almost a sense of frustration with what's happening. Certainly a sense of where are our leaders, which I think is part of it.
I'm really interested in the phenomena of the Black Lives Matter in the middle of a virus, and people risking their health and other people's health for something that was deemed to be more important.
Well, you know, I think that does go back to that concept of hope, that, you know, if you live in a society or in a community and you believe that your life doesn't matter to the community, it's hard to have hope. And therefore, why not protest? Why not go out and break social distancing rules? You know, if my life feels trivial anyway, then what do I actually have to lose? I think that's part of the mindset. And I also think the other thing that we've kind of touched on before is the whole Black Lives Matter movement has just been, or maybe I should say, has had kerosene poured on it by this virus, which just has highlighted what does it mean to be an ethnic minority in America compared to being majority white. And what it means is you're three times more likely to get the virus and potentially two to three times more likely to die from the COVID-19 virus. So again, what you get is further evidence that my life means less to my community. And therefore, why not protest? Why not go out in the streets?
And that certainly explains it for those people, but there was more support in this Black Lives Matters here in Australia, because obviously there's equally as many problems for the First Nations people here as there is in America, but many more supporters came out this time.
They did, which was great to see. However, you know, and I don't know the numbers and the breakdown of the age groups and possible political alliances, which I think would have been fascinating to see what portion of the community did show up. My gut tells me a lot of the people that showed up to support the Black Lives Matter movement, who were not of an ethnic background or First Nations background, I should say, were probably more likely to be young, more likely to be a Labour Party versus Liberal Party, or more likely to be a non-Labour, non-Liberal voter, such as a Green supporter or many of the other parties that we have that really kind of plant a strong opposition to our very powerful two-party system like they have in the US.
Now that's really interesting too, isn't it? Because I have to own up here that I went to the one here in Adelaide, and
yes.
I was one of the 6,000. You were right, there were many more young people than people my age. The party political wasn't evident. You know, the partisanship wasn't evident, but what was evident was the huge amount of support that was there. And one of the things that one Aboriginal woman said to the crowd, that it was one of the feelings of greatest solidarity that I've ever felt, was she talked to her son who was there with her, and she said, "Son, look out here, all these people are here to support you." And it brought a tear to everyone's eye.
Oh, I what a moving statement. And, you know, potentially, I think the subtext of that is, look at these people here to support you, and look at how many of them are not First Nation. Look at how many of them are actually from our global Australian community, not just our First Nations community. I think that's kind of the more powerful statement, is that we're now starting to see that the broader community is beginning to take on board a greater understanding of the struggle and how marginalized groups like First Nations are.
Yes. And I felt that was something to be hopeful about.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I know there's a lot of controversy about all the stuff happening in the US with the pulling down of statues and, you know, the changing of names. However, I can say this having lived in the US for 20 years of my life, I can't remember a time in the US where not only were there protests, but those protests were actually followed by dramatic community change. You know, with the renaming of places and people finally being aware, maybe, you know, the name of the American football team, you know, the Washington Redskins, that maybe that is potentially an offensive term to First Nations people.
Mm, that's interesting.
So now they've actually acknowledged that before the year is out, potentially the name will be changed.
So it was no coincidence, really, that it was in the middle of a pandemic.
I think it does speak to that sense of people are feeling vulnerable. And maybe when, for the first time in your life, you feel vulnerable, you begin to resonate with other people who have been vulnerable their entire life. It's like, oh, wow, finally I get it. I get what it's like to be vulnerable. I finally get what it's like to think, am I going to be here in a month or two? What's going to happen to my family? Am I going to have a job? Am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my house? I think also there's been this global frustration. I think that's been going on for at least 10 years, if not longer, a global frustration with political leadership in the West.
And a lack of trust.
Oh, absolutely. And such a key word, trust. You know, I think this is one of the amazing things that has come out of the pandemic. When you look at countries that have done the best in the pandemic, in controlling it, I think we touched on this before, it's not about a political party that runs the country or a political system that the country is aligned to, be it capitalism or communism or socialism. But what probably the primary driving factor is how much trust the national population has in their leaders. And if they have strong trust, they adhere to the guidelines that their leaders have put out there and constantly remind them of. And, you know, there is growing evidence that, you know, one of the greatest nations that's done that is New Zealand. I'm not saying we've not done badly. I think we've done very well. But you look at a country like America, where, you know, it's just been tragically sad to watch, but also fascinating to see how split that country is over the concept of, is this a real pandemic? Is this a serious illness? Or is this just, you know, stuff being blown out of proportion? And it's clear that split is strongly driven down political lines.
Like, all around us, we see USA imploding. We see the horror in Hong Kong and China, and, you know, all the military maneuvers that people are making in all around us, and the enormous amount of money that has just gone into improving Australia's defence. And all the meantime, people are still living in caravans because their house burned down in the bushfire.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Hong Kong, because I was listening to a wonderful discussion on the New York Times podcast about the timing of the new laws in Hong Kong and how the Chinese government did the press release of the new laws. They were released to the general public in Hong Kong about 11 p.m. on the last day of July. So literally an hour before it turns July 1st, the new laws come out suggesting who could be arrested for, you know, anti-government acts or acts of sedition or acts of terrorism. And there's a very strong argument that the Chinese government did this deliberately because they are painfully aware that July 1st is the number one protest day in Hong Kong of any day of the year. And so if you release these new laws 1 hour before the day that the government knows is going to be the largest protest date, and these laws suggest, but no one's had time to read the, you know, hundreds of pages related to them, people don't trust that they're safe to go out and protest. And, you know, it was a suggestion that this was a very powerful manipulation by a government to completely derail any trust that you'd be safe the following day if you went out to protest. And it, I think, was a great demonstration of how trust dramatically influences people's behavior.
Why do governments want people not to trust them?
Well, this was about, it's not that we don't want you to trust us on that day. If you're thinking about protesting, don't trust that you'll be safe. In the back of your mind, the government has now planted a seed. You may potentially, if you're caught protesting tomorrow, you may face up to 10 years in jail. Which is a terrifying thought.
And most of them are really young people.